Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast.
I'm Dave Marshall and you're joining me here at the Colorado Convention Center in Denver for the Geological Society of America's annual conference on this, their 125th year. So it's a pretty big event, well, it's a pretty big occasion for the GSA, and it's actually a pretty big conference. It's the biggest one that I've ever been to, at least. It's in this massive convention hall that's like multi-floored. There's been at least three floors that I've been on so far, and I'm here in the big poster hall, which is about the size of a soccer pitch. And what I'm hoping to do here is to kind of do a daily multimedia blog of just my experiences here at the conference, who I'm talking to, the kind of things that I'm seeing. And I'm going to be bringing that to you every night, hopefully, so long as I get the edits done. And then in a few days, I'm going to be moving on to the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting in Los Angeles, and I'll be doing the same there. So we've got about 8 days, I think, that I'm going to be doing this kind of vlog. So I'd be very pleased to have you join me, and I hope that you enjoy listening. So in the poster sessions, I've come across one on the stratigraphy and paleoecology of Pleistocene deposits associated with giant ground sloths from Page Country, Iowa, and Professor Harold Ray.
Just Harold Ray.
is here with us. So, giant ground sloths, can you tell us a little about those, please?
They're just megafauna that basically roamed the central mid-sections of the United States during the Pleistocene, so we're talking last 1.8 million years.
And in this work that you've done, you've actually identified that the ground sloths were in this area from as little as 10,000 years.
Well, during 10,000 years ago, that's when the last glacial maximum, the glaciers were pulling back from the North America. So at this time, they had a big aspect on their demise. They couldn't adjust to the new climatological aspects that were being shown in middle America, and that's basically when all the megafauna started going away from central America.
Well, that's not very long ago still. I mean, nope. I think a few people would be surprised that you had such animals.
Yeah, geologically, that's just yesterday. But yeah, if you look back at the megafauna in North America, we had camels, rhinos, large smilodon, saber-toothed tigers. We had a very large array of animals.
So how big was this giant ground sloth then?
Megalonyx jeffersonii here ranged anywhere from 8 to 10 feet tall, 2,500 pounds. Had a girth around the waist of about 19 feet. So he was a very large animal, yes.
And do we have any ideas then of paleoecology, what it was living off, and what kind of environments it actually lived?
We're looking at this picture down here, which shows it was very wet, very lush, and we're fairly sure that they lived on tree leaves, something like this. So when you're talking about an environment of lush plant, swampy, high water tables, this would be perfect for him.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
So we've got another poster here by Jeanette Sullivan, who's been looking at body side trends in ammonites at the Plains-Bakken-Terracian extinction event. Could you tell us what's been going on here?
So basically we looked at tons of specimens all around in the time period around the Plains-Bakken-Terracian extinction, and we saw that after the extinction, the body size tended to be larger than the specimens that we collected from before the extinction. So it might mean that the extinction favored the larger ammonites, or that families that tended to have a larger body size appeared after the extinction. So we also highlighted a particular family, the Hildoceratidae, who span the entire time period, and those also tend to be larger afterwards. So we're thinking that the size increase suggests that torsion extinction favored the larger ammonites, and the patterns could be a result of differences in the ecology or biology of the ammonites compared to other marine groups. And
yeah, it's great. And about yourself, you're just a high school student still, aren't you?
Yes, I did an internship at UC Santa Cruz over the summer with my mentor Matthew Clapham, and yeah, this was my summer project.
So how did you get that internship? Is that something that they advertised and you applied for?
No, I heard of it from one of my friends. She actually did a different internship program that's also at UC Santa Cruz, but we were looking at this one and I decided to just apply for it, and I was selected for it, and yeah.
And so are you looking to become a paleontologist?
I'm not sure. It's really, the internship was really kind of in the geosciences. So there's tons of different projects that all the interns did, and this was the one that I was given. And it was pretty interesting, but I'm not sure if it's what I want to do when I'm college, you know.
Boo. You're never coming on PaleoCast again. Thank you. So we're here with John Wallace from the Department of Geology and Environmental Earth Sciences at Miami University, and he's got a poster here, and it's got it's to do with identification of fossil leaves. Now, to me, I need some help in this because all the leaves just look exactly the same. So what is it that you've been trying to do?
All right, my study has focused on using the cuticle of fossil leaves, that is the waxy layer that you would see on a plant today. It does preserve fairly well. It is fairly resistant to reducing conditions. So we can look at this cuticle underneath a microscope, and it acts almost like a fingerprint would, helping to tell apart different morphotypes or informal species designations. So my study focused specifically on Ethiopia in what is a present-day Mush Valley on the Ethiopian plateau. The rocks age to about the Miocene, so 22 million years ago. And what we do is we look at the macro fossil, and we scrape a little bit of the fossil off and subject it to a series of acid baths, including tetrasodium pyrophosphate decahydrate and hydrofluoric acid, to help prepare the specimen. From there, I mount it on a slide for microscopic analysis and use epifluorescent microscope to look at it further. And if there is cuticle preserved, it will glow or fluoresce under the microscope, and I can take a picture of it. Now, these pictures can be used to help tell apart the different macrofossils. So what I've done is taken pieces off of very well-preserved macrofossils and looked at their cuticle and taken those pictures. And then I can apply that to poorly preserved macrofossils that I only have bits and pieces of. And if they have cuticle present, I can look at that cuticle and then match it up with the corresponding macrofossil as a means of identification. There's been some interesting little studies within my main chunk of research in which macrofossils that look alike on the surface have very different microfossil features, such as thickened trichome bases, different positions of stomata, things like that. Conversely, I have macrofossils that look very different in appearance but have identical cuticle features, thus showing that they come from the same morphotype. Additionally, I have used undulation index, or how sinuous a cuticle cell is, to help further split apart cuticle features that would otherwise be indistinguishable. Overall, this cuticle has proven to be an effective metric at telling apart the macrofossils and the microfossils, and we hope to explore this further.
Pro. Thank you very much. So I've caught up with Ryan Morgan from Baylor University, and he's here with a poster on blastoids. So could you tell us a little bit about blastoids? What are they?
Blastoids are small-stemmed echinoderms, very similar to crinoids. Crinoids are known as the sea lilies. They had large, big stems, big open fronds. Blastoids had these small, little stems. They're known as the sea buds because they look kind of like closed flowers. They don't have the big arms or anything. They are a much more sad, tragic group than the crinoids in the fact that these had a very quick, full, explosive radiation in the Mississippian, and then by the Permian, they're gone. They appear, they proliferate, and then they're just gone. We don't know what happened. So what this is trying to focus on what kind of environmental controls are drawing them in, developing them, and what may have triggered some of that.
Okay, and so what do you think was the trigger for the explosive radiation and unfortunate demise?
I think it was for the explosive radiation in the early Mississippi, and we had these large spread carbonate ramps, and I think it was just an ideal point in time for them to go crazy and grow. Later in the Mississippi, and these ramps are gone, we have this glaciation kick in, it gets cold. I think they just couldn't put up with it. And they may have been getting out-competed by their crinoid friends. For their extinction, I think it was environmental as well. I think they just couldn't keep up. They weren't radiating fast enough. Their bodies have these solid theca. They're not flexible. So they couldn't adapt, couldn't change, couldn't make up for it. So they just dwindle and die. It is sad.
So with Charlotte Brassey of Manchester University, of which I'm an alumni, so it's very nice to have someone who sounds normal at this conference. So you've been looking at MOA. Can you tell us a little bit about them, please?
Sure, yeah. So not many people really understand exactly what the MOA were. The MOA were a group of ratites living on New Zealand. We now know
what's a ratite?
So
is it like a little rat thing?
No, it's like ostrich, emu, cassowary, those kind of things. So anything with a sternum that's lacking a keel, if you want the official definition. So basically, yeah, big flightless birds. And they were extremely diverse and extremely successful on New Zealand until good old humans hunted them to extinction very, very rapidly around about 600 years ago.
So were they just on New Zealand? So we've got other ratites on different continents like Africa. You've got your ostrich and your emus and your rhea in South America, isn't it?
Yeah.
So were they just limited to New Zealand?
Yes, they were. Yeah. So your ratites is one of your classic case studies of vicariant speciation. You find them all across Gondwana, on all of the even fossil ratites on Antarctica, Seymour Island off Antarctica. So yeah, the MOA have been isolated on New Zealand for around about 60 million years when Zealandia, the proto-continent, split off. And yeah, that's the only place you find them. And interesting fact of the day, the closest relative of the MOA is not the kiwi. You would assume that, because they're both ratites and they both live on New Zealand, but actually the closest living relative of the MOA is the flighted tinamou of South America.
So how can you tell that?
The wonderful thing about MOA is that they are extinct, and they went extinct at a time where we don't have written documentation. So that's kind of cool and interesting. But they're not so old that we don't have lots of fossils, and we also have DNA. So we've done whole genome mitochondrial DNA sequencing of all the species. So we know that both based on the molecular and morphological phylogenies. They're most closely related to tinamou, yeah?
So when people are thinking about cloning extinct animals, should we be thinking more of MOA, less of mammals?
Yeah, you know, if it's possible, I don't see why not. They'd be reasonable farm animals, I'd reckon. You can farm ostrich, can't you? And you can farm emu for oil and feather.
So you reckon they'd be pretty tasty then?
Well, humans certainly found them to be tasty when they first arrived on New Zealand. I would imagine so. I imagine it just tastes like ostrich.
And is that what contributed to their decline?
Yes, yeah, very much so. So there's very decent evidence that it was almost entirely human-caused. It pretty much moved through the North and South Island in a wave. There was some habitat loss as well, but also anthropogenic. So they were cutting down the forest and eating the MOA at the same time.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Right, something that I've come across that I'm a little ashamed to have never seen before is receptaculitids, I think.
Receptaculitids, yes.
Well, there you go,
it's
that's how you say them, yeah. And to me, they kind of look a mix between a plectrum and a shoe.
Yeah.
Could you tell us what they actually are?
So they've been argued about what kind of animals these actually are, or if they even are animals. Some people have argued that they might be a calcareous algae. A lot of arguments have been leaning towards sponges, which is what I my study has leaned more towards sponges, definitely. But they've been named all kinds of wacky things since the 1700s, the strangest being pine cones, with this strange kind of helicoid arrangement of compact tessellated surface. They're very beautiful, and these are a very unusual type from the Arrow Canyon Range in Nevada. And they occur in association with that extensive oncolytic shoal unit that was off the western coast of Laurentia. And at the time, Nevada would have been about 15 degrees south of the equator, so a nice, warm, shallow water environment. And these would have been on just the lagoonal side, the protected side of this oncolytic shoal, and they would have been filter feeders in a strange environment that really only had receptaculitids and these large filter-feeding macularidid snails. But this is a particularly interesting morphology because it has kind of deferred from some of the radially symmetrical, almost like an inverted dinner plate, shallow sort of a form. And we've kind of changed into this sort of, I've nicknamed it an ancient oil lamp morphology, but like a shoe, you could say, or maybe a shallow clog or something like that, where you have the nucleus end here. And they started growing out as sort of an inverted dome shape. And then sort of like corals kind of slump over their own weight, but they correct their opening. Their aperture is always upward. And this seems very analogous to sponges and their osculum. But this morphology is also different from these other ones that just had maybe a little depression, but not a significant opening. And also because they correct themselves like this, it just really seems a lot like sponges. But back to just basic information on receptaculitids. They originated in the Lower Ordovician, which is rather odd. There's no record of them being in the Cambrian. And they sort of filled in where the Archaeocyathes vacated. And this would have been a time where we didn't have major reefs. We had this oncolytic shoal system of low mounds of oncolites. And these would have been just on the protected side of that unit. So, yeah, you probably haven't heard of them because they are quite unusual. And it still hasn't been resolved, even though they've been widely published. And there's been an argument for ages since the 1730s, I believe, when it was first described as to what they are. And they do only occur from the Ordovician to the... They really start to dwindle by the end of the Devonian, and they kind of peter out by the Carboniferous. There's some arguments that they might have extended to the Permian. But they were prevalent throughout the Great Basin. All of these throughout Nevada and Utah into eastern California, they occur all over the place, mostly in the small dome form. The only place you get this large oil lamp form is at the Arrow Canyon Range and then about 200 kilometers west in Death Valley. But they are quite unusual. People still have argued. It has not been definitively concluded if they are sponges. My research has pointed that direction of sponges. Wow.
Just as a flock of pigeons yes. flies through the convention center, which is indoors, I might add. So I've managed to catch up with Mark McMenamin, who on the last day here at GSA has got to talk about a Mesozoic kraken, of all things. So could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, this is a piece of research that began in trying to study the rocks, not the fossils. I was curious about this formation in Nevada. It's called the Lu Ning Formation. And there was controversy over whether it was a deep water site or a shallow water site. So I visited this site to try to determine the water depth of the strata. And I was struck by the site's most prominent feature and the reason that it's famous, and that is the ichthyosaur skeletons that are preserved at the site. And there are a series of 9 ichthyosaurs in what's called the Fossil House Quarry. It's now a covered site, very beautifully protected by the state of Nevada. And as I walked in there, originally intending to study the rocks, I was struck by the fossils and the bones of the ichthyosaurs. There was something wrong at this site, and I couldn't initially put my finger on it. But the organization of the bones, it didn't look, well, for want of a better word, it didn't look natural. It looked like they had been organized by an intelligent agent. And this then led to our hypothesis of the Triassic kraken that had killed these giant seagoing reptiles, brought them down to its lair, and deposited them on its midden, and then began to organize and play with the bones.
So how come you came up with that idea opposed to saying that the bones of the ichthyosaurs are arranged in a strange way? We can't explain that, but they are arranged in a strange way. How did the Kraken come into it?
Well, once again, I was looking at this from a sediment perspective and sedimentological and the nature of the rocks. And one thing that struck me about the bones is that they were in positions that were hydrodynamically unstable. Even if currents had moved them around, they couldn't have left them in that position because they were hydrodynamically unstable positions. That will be the main focus of my talk on Wednesday afternoon. I've developed a simple probabilistic model that essentially demonstrates that it's impossible to put the bones in the organization that you find them by currents. Currents could not be responsible for this. So we need some other mechanism. And believe me, the Kraken idea was not my first idea here. I went through a number of possible hypotheses trying to come up with a proper explanation, and these all failed. And so, in a sense, it was a process of elimination. And the Kraken hypothesis is the hypothesis of last resort. Nothing else explains the site. The Kraken hypothesis explains everything at the site.
Okay, and so why would a Kraken position the bones in this way? Is there any kind of similar behaviors in any related animals that you can observe today?
The Seattle Aquarium a few years ago was quite puzzled because the sharks in their large shark tank were mysteriously dying. They couldn't figure out what was wrong. So they set up a video camera at night to catch the culprit, and indeed they did. It turned out to be a giant Pacific octopus that during the day was hiding out in crevices in the artificial stone in the tank, and then at night would creep out and attack the sharks, kill them, and drag them down to the bottom of the tank. So we have a modern example of cephalopod behavior that's very aggressive towards large, dangerous animals. And we think that the Seattle tank incident is a microcosm of what was happening in the Mesozoic in an epic battle between giant ichthyosaurs and a giant cephalopod. And this makes a lot of sense geologically because the ichthyosaurs were among the first tetrapods or land-dwelling animals to return to the sea. They were new at this. They were newcomers to the marine situation. The cephalopods had a 350 million year head start on them, and so they were well prepared to defend their territory, and I think that's exactly what was going on. The ichthyosaurs were diving down, feeding on cephalopods, and the larger, deeper cephalopods were not happy about this, and so they counterattacked.
Okay, and do you think that this could be used to explain some of the other assemblages of bones that we might be able to find that don't have a particularly good hydrodynamic explanation?
That may be possible. However, I spoke to Dolph Seilacher, who is the world's most famous paleontologist, about this site. He was intrigued by it, and he said, there's no other site like this, Mark. This one is really unique. None of the other ichthyosaur or mesozoic cephalopod sites are like this one.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
So now we've got Jennifer Bauer from Ohio University, who's been looking at the evolution and morphological differentiation of Ordovician brachiopods. Could you tell us what you've been looking at and why, please?
So we're looking at Theriodonta and Eocnides, which have been synonymized on multiple occasions and then re-identified as valid taxon on more multiple occasions. So what we're looking to find is if, when we quantify this in morphospace and create a phylogenetic analysis from the data I've collected, are they in fact individual genera or if they're the same genera?
So they just really, really look like each other then?
Yes. There's only one character that actually has been used to identify them as distinct genera. And what my analyses have showed is that that character is not a valid character for morphological differentiation.
Okay. So have you been able to differentiate the two now that you've got rid of the only distinguishing character?
Well, I haven't gotten rid of it. So what I mean by that is that this character only appears in about five of the specimens that I measured. That would be 524 specimens. So it could potentially just be a preservational issue. It only appears in molds that I find more so than actual individual specimens that come out of the rock. But what what that means is that this character appears multiple times in the tree, which means it's a homoplasy rather than a synapomorphy, so it's not driving a clade. It's independently derived.
Okay, so were you able to actually distinguish the two then? Come up with certain characters that you can say is distinctive of one genus opposed to the other genus?
No, this is proving that they're the same genus. So Theriodonta, the name Theriodonta, should be removed and everything should be re-identified as Eocnides.
So we're here with Ellen Schall of Stanford University,
yep.
Who's got a poster on the body size evolution in conodonts all the way throughout the history, Cambrian to the Triassic. Conodonts, they've got a long history, really, from just examining their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't really had much detail on the actual body fossil.
There was
toilet roll.
Yeah, about 100 years in there where we didn't even know what they came from. I think it was suggested that they were plants, that they were invertebrates. And now finally we have soft body fossils to show that they were actually probably stem vertebrate group. So they have tooth-like parts that are made of apatite, just like our teeth.
Okay, but with so few body fossils, how can you do any kind of inference as to how the body size evolved?
Yeah, so here in this project, I'm using the size of the tooth as a proxy for the size of the whole animal. And what gives me good confidence in that is there are a lot of the closest extant relatives of conodonts are the hagfish, and there's a really good correlation in the hagfish between their tooth size and their body size. Also, in the few body fossils that we have for the conodonts, definitely the larger ones have much larger elements as well. So
how did the body fossil? So how did the body size evolve then?
So when we looked at body size throughout their whole evolutionary history, we find that it increases from about the Cambrian to the Devonian and then decreases until they go extinct at the end of the Triassic, sort of the overall pattern that we see. And this was pretty surprising to me. I expected that the size would actually mirror the diversity history. It would be very similar to the diversity of conodonts through time. But it turns out that those do not correlate at all, and that the size is really decoupled from diversity. It's its own story. The other expectation we had is we might see something like size increasing through time and then the conodonts going extinct. So that's called Cope's rule, that lineages get larger through time. And then that coupled with the idea that larger taxa tend to be at higher risk of extinction. But actually to see the conodonts decrease in size for hundreds of millions of years, it's a really interesting problem for us. We had to figure out what's going on here. Our first hypothesis was that there might be some kind of environmental marginalization. So they're getting maybe pushed aside by other potential competitors and predators like the cephalopods or the fish. But we still haven't figured out the answer to that question yet because we didn't get really good correlations with those groups yet. But the next step in this project is to look at sort of different taxonomic levels. So perhaps it's a more specific fish group that they might be competing with, such as the bony fish. That's the next stage of this project.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this first episode, so I hope that you've enjoyed listening. As this is going out on the same day that I'm recording it, please feel free to get in touch if you have any comments or want anything changing, or if you know who's talking and want me to try and get hold of someone in particular, I'd be more than happy to go and talk to those people for you. So thanks again for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.